Hi, this is Candace Smith. Welcome to the Faith Center Podcast Network. We want to be a source of hope, joy, and encouragement on your drive to work, your time at home, or anywhere in between. Be sure to like and subscribe to get all of our daily and weekly content. For more information about Faith Center and the podcast network, please visit our website, lg4square.com, lg4square.com. If you would like to be a part of the conversation, you can email the show at podcast@lg4square.com. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Barnabas Project. Today we are continuing on in our series in Revelation. This is going to be a really fun conversation, but it's going to be some hard conversation too.
It's going to get dark a little bit, but hang in there.
We're going to be getting into some more eschatology today. We're going to be going down some the trumpet judgments.
Well, technically the seventh seal.
Yeah, we're going to start with the seventh seal,
and then the majority of the trumpets.
Yes. So I want to kind of do a recap of where we've been so far, and Royce, you can just jump in and correct me if I miss something.
Okay.
So our series started thus far in Revelation 1, and that's our first series in Revelation where we talk about the prologue, where John is basically given the commission to write everything down that he sees, and he's on the island of Patmos, so he's exiled for his faith, you know, big shocker there. And he's given this vision from Jesus to write everything down that has been and is being and is to come. And then after he spends some time in true John fashion saying who Christ is, then we get on to the churches in Revelation. You know, and I kind of want to just pause real quick because there's a lot of conversation about if this is the Apostle John, or if this is some guy named the Elder John. And I personally believe it to be the Apostle John because of the fact that he starts this off by proclaiming who Jesus is. And that's in true John fashion, like we see in the Gospels and we see in the epistles that he wrote. But I'm interested if somebody's got some other thoughts on it being the Elder John. I think that's an interesting conversation too. So then when we get into the churches, we spend some time hearing about the correction and the good things that Jesus had to say about these churches. And he sent them individual letters through John and gave them things that they needed to work on and gave them their blessings as well. And we finish up in chapter 3, finishing the churches and head into the throne room of God. And that's chapter 4. And boy, Royce, we had a fun time on that one.
That was a good time.
So the throne room of God was really fun, really interesting. You get to see John ascend up into heaven and spend some time looking at creatures, talking to Christ.
He talks to angels. He talks to the 24 elders that are before the throne. He really gets to talk to about everybody. You know, he's just meeting people. He's
taking a look around at some really...
Wouldn't you want to take a look around?
I'd be spending as much time as I could.
He meets the four creatures that are before the throne that we see a picture of in Ezekiel.
Yep, and this is where we get our first song in heaven. And it's the Holy, Holy, Holy Lord God Almighty, who was, who is, and who is to come. So then we go into chapter 5, and we see that the Lamb takes the scroll. And then we sort of spend some time in 5 talking about why Jesus is worthy to take the scroll and open the seals. And then through chapter 6, we see Jesus, the Lamb, opening the 7 seals, or really 6 seals in those chapters. And then we go on to talk about the 144,000 in chapter 7, and we spend some time dialoguing on that. And then now we're going to continue on into Revelation 8.
And just to hit real clearly on the seals that Jesus opened, he starts off with the four horsemen, and that was a great study that we went through with Pastor Ted here. And then he goes into the seal about the martyrs, the seal about a terror, some great thing approaching or happening. And as we were talked about, there's a couple ways to look at these seals, and we'll be talking about that again today. But they're either linear and they all happen one at a time, and then the next one opens and then that thing happens, or they're all opened and these things are kind of all happening together, and then trumpets are mixed in to what's happening with the seals. So we'll explore that as we go along too.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. There's a couple of different ways we can look at that. I think that this is a more three-dimensional book and everything isn't perfectly linear. That's just how I read it because of some of the things that come on down the road later. And so we'll talk about that like Royce just mentioned. So let's go ahead and jump into Revelation chapter 8 and then dialogue about that. So this is when Christ is going to open the seventh seal. Chapter 8, verse 1. When the Lamb opened the seventh seal, there was a silence in heaven for about a half an hour. Then I saw the seven angels who stood before God, and seven trumpets were given to them. Another angel came and stood at the altar with a golden censer, and he was given much incense to offer with the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints rose before God from the hand of the angel when the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire from the altar and threw it on the earth. And there were peals of thunder, rumblings, flashes of lightning, and earthquakes. So let's pause there and talk about the opening of the seventh seal. What do you got there, Royce?
So the first thing that struck me, and I just didn't want to overlook it, is the silence in heaven for about a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was reading some commentaries on this, and one particular one said, if a preacher just stopped preaching for a half an hour, but you weren't excused, you weren't supposed to leave, it would feel like a really long time because it would feel that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so interesting about this is heaven's just been filled with praises and songs and really amazing things, essentially up until the starting of the opening of these seals. But now this one causes silence. I mean, 6 was pretty devastating.
Yeah.
And we'll tie 6 in a little bit to what's happening as we move on through this. But even that didn't provoke silence. This provoked a half an hour of silence. And so I just wanted to kind of expand on this idea of silence. Exodus 14:14 says, the Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. I like that one.
Oh, that's good.
Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts, on your beds, and be silent. That's Psalms 4:4. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. Lamentations 3:26. And so I just thought that it's just so powerful. It's just so interesting of an idea that we're commanded. We don't have to fight our own battles. We don't have to say things on our own behalf so much. The Lord.
You can even say, maybe stop talking so much.
Exactly. I could say that to myself a lot too, but it's just powerful. Silence is powerful.
Yeah. You know, I got another verse here on the silent topic. So Zephaniah 1:7-13, be silent before the Lord God, for the day of the Lord is near. The Lord has prepared a sacrifice and consecrated his guests. And on the day of the Lord's sacrifice, I will punish the officials and the king's sons and all who array themselves in foreign attire. On that day, I will punish everyone who leaps over the thresholds and those who fill their master's house with violence and fraud. Mm-hmm. So this is almost sort of a prophecy fulfilled here. Well, this is a prophecy fulfilled here. We kind of get this vision here with Zephaniah where he says on the day of the Lord, there will be a great silence. And he gives the reasons why these judgments are coming down, or at least a list of reasons why some of these judgments are coming down the road.
Mm-hmm. 1 Kings 19:9-13. So this is Elijah, and this is such an interesting point because we're going to be talking about Elijah real soon.
Yes, we are.
So what has happened here is Elijah's just called down fire from heaven. He's pretty much the ultimate awesome dude.
He's got superpowers.
He's got superpowers. And he runs into a person who says that Jezebel's going to kill him. And it frightens him so much that he takes off running. And that's where this verse comes in, because it starts out, then he came there to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He said, "I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away." So he said, "Go forth, stand on the mountain before the Lord." And behold, the Lord was passing by, and a great strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing. Then Elijah heard it. He wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" So here's an earthquake, a strong wind, a fire, all these things. God's not in those things. He's in the silence. He's in the stillness. And so I think that's important for us to remember as we jump into all the devastation that we're going to talk about coming up here. God's not in the earthquakes, the fires, and these things that are coming. These are judgments. They're cleansing things to come upon the earth. God is in this moment of silence here.
Yeah, that's good. Psalm 14, 1 through 2. O Lord, I call upon you. Hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I call to you. Let my prayers be counted as incense before you, and the lifting up of my hands as evening sacrifice. When the census was thrown down to earth, it was filled with the prayers of these saints and with a burning sacrifice. And so let's just define what a census is here. It's basically just a fiery bowl. Mm-hmm. And the angel took this bowl and he threw it on the earth. And then we see judgment follow.
Yeah. So this is interesting thing. When you're talking about these prayers, something I wanted to read was 2 Peter chapter 3, 10 through 14. "But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be? In holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning and the elements will melt with intense heat." So I just thought this was really interesting that we need to be looking forward to God's return, and that even by living holy and good lives, like doing what we're supposed to do for the kingdom, that there's even this thought that we could hasten the day of the coming of the Lord. And so I feel like what's happening here with the altar, the prayers that are getting mixed with the incense, you know, this is that day that Peter's talking about. Mm-hmm. Or you know, the start of it, the start of the process here. And this is what Peter's commanding us. Like, this is what you're working towards. You're working towards this cleansing by being in prayer, by, you know, living that holy, godly life that we're commanded to live. We're bringing the kingdom to earth.
Yeah, so let's kind of define these angels for a minute. We see seven angels, and then we see a great angel. So these seven angels that are standing in the presence of God are pretty, all of them have to be pretty important angels. And just throwing this out, how important these angels are, I'm looking at Luke 1:18, and we see that Gabriel calls himself one that stands in the presence of God. So we're talking about angels that important, that are equally important as Gabriel. But there's a lot of different opinions on who this great angel is. And there are some that would say it's Christ. Mm-hmm. There are some that would just say it's a pretty amazing angel.
Yeah, and I've heard that this word "another" is meaning another after its kind. So if you were to say, "Give me another candy bar," you'd be implying, "I want another candy bar that's like..."
That's a great idea. I actually got some candy.
Got some candy here. I wonder where that came from. So you're saying that I want another candy bar. Mm-hmm. You're not just using that word to basically say any other kind of thing. You're implying something after its own kind. So you do have that argument that this other angel is something completely, just a different angel. Like maybe it's Michael or an unnamed angel we've never heard of in the Bible. And that same argument is going to come back up in Revelation 10
yeah.
as well. And we don't know if this is the same angel that's in 10.
No, we don't.
And it doesn't say, because honestly, it really isn't important to what's happening in context of this chapter. But a lot of people do like to get wrapped up in who these angels are. And then you have people that say all these angels essentially are Christ. And that yep, always doesn't
I've seen
work.
That same thing, yeah.
When you start breaking it down, I mean, it could in some places, but in others, not so much.
I don't think it changes the story.
It really doesn't.
When we find that maybe these angels are all just angels, like it right. says.
yeah.
It doesn't change the story. Either way, it's power that it's given from Christ and God that it's bestowed upon these angels, and then they carry out his will.
Right. I think it's an angel, like just a powerful angel.
Mm-hmm.
This seven angels that stand before God's actually a really interesting concept. So you won't find this in the Old Testament, and yet it's a Hebrew custom. It's a tradition that they believed that there are seven angels that stand before God. Now, we've talked before about the seven spirits. We went to Isaiah and looked at those seven attributes of the Holy Spirit. But this idea of seven angels that just stand before the throne is a Hebrew one. And I think that this verse is going to confirm that for them, for the 144,000, when they do convert, you know, and they maintain their Jewishness, but they also convert to Christianity too. So I think that's going to be a really interesting thing. That's like, hey, we always knew this was going on.
Yeah.
We always knew that this was a thing, but we never had a specific verse to go back to.
The verbiage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So let's move on to the seven trumpets. So we just covered the seventh seal, and now we see that these seven angels are given trumpets, and they're to sequentially blow them off, and then we see judgment following. And like Royce had already previously said, we are going to actually see a cleansing take place here of the land. And these are limited judgments, so that needs to be said. So this is actually the third sevenfold thing we're going to see happen in Revelation.
So it's interesting, and I feel like we both take the stance that the seals are all happening in conjunction
yeah.
with the trumpets, even though there are people who say it's all 100% linear. And if you want to believe that, you know, do your own research and make that point for yourself. But what's really interesting to me is how the seals have no like regard for time.
Mm.
They're just stuff. I mean, there are four writers. It's a general martyrship of pretty much anybody Christian. It's some giant terrorist thing. And then this seal, which we just opened, it unleashes the seven trumpets. But the judgment itself that's connected to the seal is that mixing of the prayers with the incense from the altar and throwing it back to earth. And it creates flashes of lightning, peals of thunder, and an earthquake. Consequently, what's super interesting to me, and how I loved how you said this earlier, that this is a three-dimensional book. And I don't think we can see this whole thing with our human eyes.
I wish we could.
I know. When the seven trumpets end, they end the same way that they began.
Yeah.
This exact same phrasing, this exact same flashes of lightning, peals of thunder, and an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a secular thing even with inside of itself that they end like they begin.
Also, if you take this in a perfectly sequential order, the death toll gets much higher than if you take it in more of like a three-dimensional perspective.
That's true. It does. And yet there's some interesting stuff that we'll talk about when we get into that side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But with this whole idea that the trumpets and the seals are different and in that they do some different things, you get a lot of time-based action
mm-hmm.
with the things that happen in the trumpets. And we'll read about this as we go along here. So I'm excited to kind of talk about some of these time-based aspects to the trumpets.
Yeah, that's good. Can we really cover real quick? We're actually seeing played out in heaven a ritual sacrifice. And I think that's important to the story that we just saw play out in heaven, where we get the two altars. Mm-hmm. We get the, you know, where they do the butchering of the lamb,
mm-hmm.
and then the golden altar where they sacrifice. So let's actually go ahead and jump into the seven trumpets right now. Let's start with the first trumpet. Now the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared to blow them. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, and these were thrown upon the earth, and a third of them was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. So that was the first trumpet.
One thing I wanted to point out with these things getting thrown here, this is all actually reactionary to the fifth seal.
Dropping stuff in here, sorry.
So, you know, it's because there are these sacrifices, as John was pointing out, on these altars, because the world has martyred so many Christians at this point, that there's something to mix with that incense and throw to earth. So it's reactionary, too. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to point that out. So we went through verse 7, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I thought this was really interesting from a mathematical point of view. And so, okay.
Of course you did.
Those that know me know that, I'm kind of a robot some days. Yeah. I work in,
if you want to, if you want to confirm that, have a conversation, just talking music theory with Royce.
It's just all numbers,
I guess.
Yeah. It's all numbers.
Anyway.
So hellfire mixed with blood. So it says a third of the earth is burned up. So me being in my curious self, I had to know how much earth that is. So there are there's a little over 57 million square miles of land that's accessible. That's what's exposed. That's not the whole amount of land. That's just what, you know, we see on a map, on a globe. Okay. So a third is just shy of 19 million square miles of land. So 19 million square miles of land is essentially being burned up. Essentially, scientists estimate that only 24.5 million square miles of that 57 that I had said is the total amount is habitable land. So some of this land that's getting burned up is likely uninhabitable land, and some is habitable land. I would imagine it's probably mixed up some. Mm-hmm. So about 15 billion acres is habitable on this planet that we live on right now. A third of the trees are burned up. Okay. So 31% of the Earth's mass is forest. That would mean about 17.5 million square miles is forest. So if you recall, you know, a lot of land is getting burned up. 17 million square miles is forest, and it says of the trees, a third is getting burned up. So that's about 5.8 million square miles is burned up. And if that doesn't make any sense to you and you're having a hard time going, who cares about a square mile? I don't really understand what that is. Well, here's the breakdown. There are 640 acres in one square mile. 640 acres in one square mile. That's a lot of acres.
Blows my mind.
Okay. So that means that 3.7 billion acres is getting burned up in this one trumpet alone. If you're still having a hard time putting this into perspective of how much of the earth is going to burn on this judgment, 3.7 billion acres. This year, Oregon's worst wildfire, we all had smoke. We all talked about how the smoke was in our lungs and our eyes and all that stuff, right?
We were all kind of wearing masks anyway, yeah. And this was like sort of a really great excuse to wear them outside.
Exactly. 1 million acres was burned in Oregon. 4 million acres was burned in California. I said 3.7 billion acres are going to burn.
Man.
We don't understand that concept, what that does to us physically.
As mankind, we are designed to breathe air.
Exactly.
And carbon dioxide is what the trees convert to oxygen. So if you have that much fire burning up our oxygen source, that's not good. Mm-hmm. And I was just telling you beforehand, I don't know the exact number on this, but the tundra in itself in Canada is one of the world's biggest supplier of the Earth's oxygen. And so if we're talking about Canada's tundra.
Well, thank you for that segue, because I think this is also interesting.
Okay.
So of all of the forest landmass that I just talked about, half, more than half actually, is found in only 5 countries. Those 5 countries are Russia, Brazil, Canada, right here, home, United States, and China. Okay? The remaining is spread out over 10 countries. That should tell you how much forest is populated amongst certain countries. So essentially 15 countries of the entire world hold 100% of the forest population. 5 of those countries are going to feel the burn worse than the other 10 just by math alone, just by the math of this whole thing alone. So Russia, Brazil, Canada, United States, and China, just by the sheer math of it, will experience a significant portion, I would say at least 1.5 billion acres or more of this burning. And what's interesting is we were talking about the prayers being mixed with the incense and being thrown back to the earth, and this really starting off these trumpet judgments. Is this a reaction to the countries that persecuted Christianity hardest during this end times once the seal is opened?
I would make the argument that, yeah, there is an element of that, especially when you see that at the altar you've got the prayers of the martyrs coming out with the burning censers. Yeah,
and I agree, because it's so interesting to me that it puts in context a third of the trees or the green grass is all burned up. And by this measure, these countries are going to pay the worst. Mm-hmm. So I would think that they maybe did the worst to Christianity.
Logically speaking, I like where your head's at on that.
With that one, yeah.
Let's talk about the second trumpet. The second angel blew his trumpet, and something like a great mountain ablaze with fire was hurled into the sea. So a third of the sea became blood, a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So let's go back to your mathematical equations here.
So before I jump into math, because math is fun.
it's not, but okay.
So what PT was kind of talking about, what I think we were both also talking about when we were in the sixth seal, is it feels like something is essentially cast at Earth. Mm. And if you look at all of these things, so you first have this hellfire mixed with blood that burns up all the trees. Then you have this great mountain. And in a second, we'll see essentially a lesser type of a thing, but still in a similar sense. It really paints a picture of a comet or a meteor, some significant thing coming from outer space. These judgments are coming from outside of our world to our world to inflict a judgment upon us.
I've heard a lot of people say that this judgment is a volcano, but I kind of land on meteor myself.
Well, I agree, because it says, something like a great burning mountain was thrown into the sea. If it said something like a great burning mountain sprung up from the sea, then I'd probably go with more of a volcano type of a thing.
Yeah, and there's still some imagery there, too, where you can kind of imagine that the volcano is just throwing itself into the sea. But
I suppose.
Yep.
And I guess really for this purpose, for this particular judgment, I don't know if it'd change a ton.
No.
But this is cast to the sea, and then a third of the sea is turned to blood. Well, this doesn't even talk about tidal waves of something this massive hitting. But we can assume that there's some tidal waves in something wherever this hits. But from a mathematical point of view, so the USGS asserts that there are 321 million cubic miles.
Wow, I can't even wrap my head around that.
Of water.
Is that surface water or
all? No, that's just all the oceans.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of water. So a third would be 105 million cubic miles. That's a lot. I mean, I was trying to paint a word picture of this so that you could understand, but there's just nothing that comes close. It would be like making a spherical bubble that ran up into the sky like 35 miles. Mm-hmm. And you can't imagine that. So you just can't fathom what kind of destruction this is. From this point of view of turning essentially 105 million cubic miles into blood, that's so huge. I personally wonder what that does to our climate.
Yeah.
Blood is thicker than water. So it's not going to heat as easily. So you're already dealing with a world that's got a lot of smoke in it from fires. I mean, massive amount of smoke is going to essentially create thicker atmosphere. So the sun's not going to penetrate anyways. Those waters are going to get real cold. I mean, the sea is going to get really, really cold really fast. Then coupled with a third of it turning to blood and that blood not essentially elevating in temperature as quickly, you're going to have really crazy sporadic weather patterns, just super bizarre stuff. It also talks about ships, a third of the ships being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So once again,
that would argue tidal wave.
Yeah.
Things of that nature.
All that kind of stuff. There's 90,000 commercial ships worldwide at sea, but there's 180,000 vessels at sea. So, you know, 60,000 vessels essentially being destroyed. It's a weird thing to throw in there, but is it really going to hamper on all the trade, just moving product around the world? It's going to completely stop.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty devastating. And then, well, that's going to affect the land, like you said, as well. So we're going to jump into the third trumpet. The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from heaven. It fell on a third of the rivers and springs of water. The name of the star was Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood. So many of the people died from the waters because they had been made bitter. So the word wormwood, actually, it comes from the idea of basically just wood that has gone bad. That's sort of the concept of it. So when they say wormwood, it means bitter. Essentially just means bitter wood.
It does mean bitter. It's also a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a herb, technically. It's known for being an ingredient in absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who know what absinthe is, it's an alcohol. And it's also used in other alcohols too, but that's just the one it's popular for. While wormwood itself is not a hallucinogenic, the plant compound called thujin, which is inside of it, is. So you could essentially harvest wormwood, remove the thujin, and not have a hallucinogenic thing and just have the herb for the taste, which is what some absinthe distillery companies claim they do.
Okay.
In small amounts, thujin probably wouldn't do anything to you. But in large amounts, it's very toxic and fatal.
You ever hear the expression, don't drink the worm? That's where this comes from.
Is it?
Probably.
I don't think so.
Well, we're just going to say it is.
Okay. So this great star falls from heaven. It's got a weird name, Wormwood. It just pops up here. It's this really interesting thing. So it falls on essentially fresh water. The water that we really care about.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of seawater out there, but seawater is kind of useless to us because we can't drink it. But fresh water is what we all need. So you've got a lot of the world on fire, a considerable amount, several billion acres on fire. You've got a third of the sea turned to blood, so you have crazy weather patterns. You already have droughts. Which we'll find out that happened from the two witnesses in chapter 11. So you're already dealing with a world with a minimal water supply as it is.
Yeah.
Tack on to it, this star falls. It says it hits the rivers and springs. So I don't know if you want to interpret springs to be like underwater groundwater, or if you just want to interpret springs to be anything that's not a river that's on the surface of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I would probably go that route myself, just things that are on the surface of the earth, because I almost envision this like a comet that comes through our atmosphere. And as it breaks apart, it enters our atmosphere and essentially pollutes the water supply. That's how I envision it in my head.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, just backing up here, so if people are curious and about water supply in the world, which I know you all are, there's
definitely
5.5 million cubic miles of underground water. But of that 5.5 million, only 2.5 million is freshwater drinkable. The rest is saline based. So let's leave that water out of the whole mix. And let's just talk about lakes, swamps, and rivers, which is actually where we get the majority of that water, even though we are drilling more and more and getting more water out that way. Because so much of the water is so far down, it's actually hard for us to get to some of those bigger, big aquifers that are below. There's 42,000 cubic miles of lakes. There's 2,700 cubic miles of swamps, 509 cubic miles of rivers, relatively nothing in the grand scheme of things, and 269 what they consider other.
Compared to the oceans, yeah.
Yeah. So if you add all that up, it's about 45,800 cubic miles of freshwater. So a third is 15,000 cubic miles of freshwater. So of those countries that hold the fresh water of the earth, there are six that have more than 50% of fresh water. Those six are Brazil, Russia, Canada, Indonesia, China, and Colombia. So if you were thinking from the tree, one where they got burned up,
you've got
four repeat offenders on here from the trees that got burned up. Brazil, Russia, Canada, and China. So those four countries, they are going to not only have a third of, you know, their forests essentially on fire, but now this water's polluted. And if you drink too much of it, you die. And so that's where that wormwood, that bitterness comes in. I would assume that based on the fact that many people drank it and died, that that thuogen compound that is found in wormwood kills them. That's what would make sense, because it is the compound inside of wormwood that's toxic and fatal to people. And if this is called wormwood and pollutes the water, that's what I would assume is a logical progression of information there.
Toxic star.
Toxic star falls, kills people. But with that thought process in mind, when you do ingest thuogen, too much of it, it does cause hallucinogenic effects right before you die. So you essentially hallucinate insanely, vomit like crazy, and die. That's how you die of thuogen.
Wormwood doesn't sound good. Let's move on to the fourth trumpet. The fourth angel blew his trumpet, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them were darkened. A third of the day was without light, and also a third of the night. I looked and heard an eagle flying high ahead, crying out in a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who live on the earth because of the remaining trumpet blast that the three angels are about to sound." So in true Revelation fashion, we see this four and three succession here.
Yeah.
Because we saw that with the seals, where you get the first four horsemen of the apocalypse, and then we go on to three more seals, and they're, you know, they get worse and worse. And so we see that same thing happening here. So when we get into these last three trumpets, this one gets talking about the sun and the moon and the stars. So what do you got for me with that?
So a third of the sun and the moon and the stars are darkened. And so as I was researching this, I found that there's really two ways that you can look at this concept. One is that we just saw some stuff that would definitely darken our atmosphere.
Yeah.
A third of the trees, essentially all plant life burning up, is definitely going to make some smoke, and it's going to stick around the atmosphere for a while when you consider that a third of the ocean is blood, and that's probably not going to make a lot of rain to, you know, wash that out of our atmosphere. So that's one aspect. Essentially, the sky is polluted from so much smoke, and it's not moving. It's not getting washed out of the atmosphere. Rain's not moving it through, like we saw here when we had all the smoke in our atmosphere, and then it rained, and then, you know, kind of like settled it, it washed it out. So that's one way to look at it. Also, to compound that thought process, when we get to the two witnesses in chapter 11, they also cause a lot of droughts that come upon the earth. So really, you're not seeing a lot of water move that way. This is the most, I would say, scientific approach to it. It's just a causality.
Yeah.
You know, because these things happened in the first trumpet.
Logically speaking, this would almost have to have happened.
Well, it will definitely happen.
Yeah.
What could also be an idea here that I wanted to throw out is that that is happening, but then there's also something blocking the sun and the moon and the stars for a third, which could be a celestial object. Essentially, think of a solar eclipse, but for a third of the day and a third of the night. That would be weird. And we don't really have a concept for that. And we don't really know what way this one's leaning, if it's just a causality from all the smoke and all the things, or if it's actually an object that has somehow locked into our gravitational pull and really just kind of hampers out the sun for a third and hampers out the night for a third.
Yeah, and it might even have something to do in, with the fifth trumpet too, where that would come into play as well. Or, you know, a combination of the fire with the smoke. And then you've got this star that we see in the fifth trumpet that falls to earth.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It could have been that as well.
It could be. It's hard to say. What we know for sure is that a third is going to be gone. And that's an easy one for you to imagine. Just take your normal day and take a third out of it. It's going to be dark. The idea here, I believe, from these first four trumpets is that your oxygen's going away. Your water's going away. A significant source of your food supply is going away, and you're going to live in darkness. So no oxygen, no water, no food, darkness is what you're getting.
So Alaska.
Sorry, Alaska.
I didn't mean that, Alaska. I'm sorry.
He's sorry. I wanted to bring up something very interesting that happened in Joshua. This is called, this is Joshua chapter 10. This is called the Five Kings Attack Gibeon. So essentially Joshua has just led the people into the promised land, and he's got to fight a lot of fights. He's got to wage a lot of war here. So he goes to war against these five kings, but he needs some extra daylight to get the job done because he doesn't want to fight in the dark apparently.
Yeah.
So Joshua chapter 10, verse 12. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Alijon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. So this is called the long day of Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of thoughts on this verse because some people, this bothers them.
We're going to get into some fringe concepts here, people. This is in no way factual by any stretch of the imagination. This is our musings. So join with us on a little journey here.
Come on down, journey. So with the long day of Joshua, you have something miraculous happening, and you could just leave it at that. You could just say that God just made it be day.
And that's totally acceptable.
Yeah, totally acceptable. The world kept spinning, everything kept moving, but they just had light all day long. Totally acceptable, completely logical way to look at miraculous things happening in the Bible.
Simply because God gets to do what God wants to do.
Right. The other way is that God uses stuff that he creates because he's amazing and exciting and such a cool creator that he uses stuff to interact with us in ways that only he could have ever orchestrated because he lives outside of time. And if you're saying to yourself, that still sounds like the first thing that you said, you wouldn't be completely wrong because it does sound like God being miraculous and awesome because he is God, but doing it with things that are here because he can. And so there's a couple theories on how this long day of Joshua occurred. And one is that essentially, God sent something into the atmosphere of the earth that essentially caused the sun to keep reflecting during that time. The moon stopped, but it kept going. Another is that he caused Mars to come very close into our orbit, which actually essentially slowed down time. And it's not time, but the world turning in a way.
Well, so that's actually interesting right now because we're in a part where Mars is really close to the earth mm-hmm. right now, and it is so red and so bright at night that it actually is brighter at night.
Yeah. And this would be like 67,000 times closer than what it is now, but still, they're interesting concepts. God did something miraculous on this day when Joshua fought the Amorites. And if you believe that he just made it light, that's awesome. If you believe he used something like Mars or another planet to do this miraculous thing, that's also awesome. And both ways are awesome.
He either pulled something out of nothing or by divine appointment had something set into place all along. Either way, God's right. Pretty awesome.
And that's what this other option to this trumpet of a third of the sun, moon, and stars could be. That yes, you do have a significant amount of smoke in the sky, but there could be another element. There could be something else. God could use another thing. Like if it was a whole bunch of meteor type things that God put on course with the earth for the exact time he wanted them to be here, that two hit us. Well, essentially a storm hits us that causes a lot of the fire. A big one hits that really sinks the ocean. And then a probably smaller one kind of pollutes the waters. But then a fourth one essentially hangs out in the solar system and gets locked into our orbit and essentially causes just what would look like a lot of eclipses.
Sure.
You know, so just throwing some ideas out there for you to consider.
Yeah. And if you really spend some time looking at the solar system and astronomy and how everything really works, if we had something enter near our solar system at all, our gravity would feel it. We would feel it in our planet as we know it. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of cool when you look at how in balance everything is and how important all the planets in our solar system really are to the relationship in Earth itself. Like the presence of Jupiter, that's more important than people even realize. And we'll probably get into that one in a little bit here too when we get to Revelation 12. Maybe not.
It is interesting, and it's so cool when you do get into studying planets and how they're formed and they develop and things like that, because you realize real quick that there's something wrong with our solar system.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lot of things wrong, but there's a lot of things right. Things that just really shouldn't happen, that are completely unnormal, that only a miraculous creator could do.
One of the wrong things, for example, is Jupiter's in the wrong place.
Yeah.
It can't be in the place that it is without God putting it there, because gas giants in solar systems are on the very perimeter. Yep. The bigger they are, the further out they are.
Yeah.
And we also see with the size of our moon, for example, it's a third of the size of the Earth, and it's facing one direction at all times. So yeah. It's even thought that the way that the moon is spinning is actually in perfect harmony with the Earth. It's not actually, it's simply spinning at the exact speed.
It could be. Mostly it's thought of that it doesn't spin at all. That it's completely tidal locked. And that's what causes our oceans to have the tidal lock that they do, which causes us to have the seasons that we have. We've never found a planet that has seasons yet. They might one day, but as far as I know of right now, they haven't. And so it's really interesting when you start talking about the moon, because when you learn about the Big Bang in school, it all sounds great up until a point where you start applying things that you learn about your solar system to it.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, none of this makes any sense. Mm-hmm. You've got planets rotating a different way than the other planets. The moon doesn't rotate at all. And the first law of thermodynamics is objects that are set in motion will stay in motion until an object of equal or greater force stops them. So that doesn't make any sense. How did the moon stop spinning? If, you know, Big Bang was true, it just wouldn't. It'd keep spinning.
I think one of the greatest arguments for creation is the fine-tuned nature of our solar system and the relationship that it provides us with our planet. And even when you look, you know, staying on the moon topic, and we didn't really know we were going to go here today. This really feels not like one of our Friday lunches, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even when you're talking about the moon, you look at its relationship to the size of the sun, and it's exactly the same to our eye.
Yeah. It allows us to have solar eclipses.
Yeah.
That's actually a phenomenon.
Yeah. The corona that you see is one of those things that when they happen, we get NASA like taking so many pictures, because it is only known in our galaxy at this time. And that's hard to explain. We can only see that and observe that at this perfect time in history. And we're talking however old you want to say the Earth is. Life is only possible here right now, and we're only able to see the perfect harmony between the sun and the moon right now. We see it play out right now. And again, I don't think you can make a good argument for there not being a God because of the way things are set into motion, the way we see them right now.
Absolutely. So as we finish up this chapter here, as Chong Min, as you read and talked about the woes, so this is not the first woe. The woe is getting announced before the woe.
Oh, okay.
So, then I looked and I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. When they happen, they will get announced, as we'll see in chapter 9. And then we'll see again in chapter 11, and then once more later on. So the woes get announced. They're just saying, hey, you guys thought it was bad that, you know, essentially 3.5 billion acres burned up and, you know, a third of your ocean's blood, and you don't have any water to drink, and, you know, you haven't seen the sun for a long time. Well, get ready, because it's going to get a lot worse real quick.
So this has been the eighth chapter in our series in Revelation. We thank you for joining us today. This has been a pretty entertaining and fun conversation to talk about the things that God is capable of doing, but it is not fun to talk about judgment. So when we see this chapter, we see that God has some harsh things to play out on the earth in the end times. So join us next week for chapter 9, and we will get into the fifth trumpet and the sixth trumpet. And then we will maybe continue on from there. We'll see what happens. All right, we love you, and we thank you guys for joining. Until next time, see you later.
Thank you for listening to the Faith Center Podcast Network. Be sure to like and subscribe for daily and weekly content. Once again, if you'd like more information about Faith Center, you can visit lg4square.com, lg4square.com. And you can email the show at podcast@lg4square.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless.